This is a YUN tape. It is an interview with Mr. F.T. Dew on September the 21st, 1990, in Bronxville, New York. The interviewer is Sutherland. Okay.
Perhaps I'd like to check.
Mr. Dew, I want to thank you for agreeing to participate in a further session in this Yale Oral History Project. And today, I would like to begin by questioning you about, first, the way in which the organization of the Secretariat under the Secretary General developed to deal with both the political and the peacekeeping problems in the Middle East that were at the heart of the wars that took place there.
Yes. Well, first let me say that it's a pleasure to participate in this project. Now, on the organization of secretariat offices dealing with peacekeeping operations, at the very beginning, there were, of course, no peacekeeping operations. And then in the 1948 and 1949, the two first peacekeeping operations was created in the form of observer missions, UNSO first, and UMOGIP in Kashmir later. At that time, the matters concerning the peacekeeping operations was dealt with by the executive office of the Secretary General. As you know, the chief of this executive office was Andrew Cordier. But the responsibility was quite minor. The mandate of the observer missions were well defined by agreements concluded by the parties. The observers were supposed to assist the parties. The role of the Secretary General was mainly administrative. Now, only later, with the arrival of Dag Hammarskjöld, that the peacekeeping operation expanded with the creation of the first peacekeeping force, UNEF-1, in the Middle East, and later with the creation of more observer missions. When Dag Hammarskjöld assumed office at the beginning of 1953, he immediately created a special office on the 38th floor, composed of two under-secretaries. At that time it was called under-secretaries and not under-secretaries general. One an American, and one a citizen of the Soviet Union, to deal with special political problems. The title of the office was first called the Office of Undersecretaries Without Portfolio. Later on, it was changed to Undersecretaries for Special Political Affairs. The first Soviet undersecretary without portfolio was Chernyshev, and the second one was Dobrynin, who later became ambassador of the Soviet Union to the United States. The Americans was Ralph Bunche, who was transferred from his previous function in the trusteeship department. Hammarskjöld and Bunche worked extremely well, but the relationship between the Hammarskjöld and the Soviet and the secretary without portfolio was quite strained. So later on, the Soviet Union requested that their and the secretary should resume the functions as head of the Department of Political and Security Council Affairs, and the post was taken by British Ambassador Trevelyan, and later on by a known a member of the non-aligned country, Buhari first, and then an Egyptian, and then later on Narasimhan. After Narasimhan, a Latin American was appointed to the post, Rose Bennett. And when Rose Bennett died, another Latin American was appointed to the post, and the post became a Latin American one. In this office, which was called the Office of Undersecretaries without Portfolio first, and then for Special Political Affairs, Bunch was dealing with all peacekeeping operations and also related problems. At that time, the peacekeeping operations was related to the Middle East and later on to Cyprus. So he was in charge of the political problems concerning the Middle East conflict and Cyprus problems.
As well as the peacekeeping operations.
And, of course, the peacekeeping operations in its various forms. He didn't want to have a large office. The office was composed of a few members. And therefore, he didn't want to take on the complex and time-consuming administrative matters. And these matters are dealt with by an office called the Field Operations Service, which belonged to the Department of General Services. But there was a very close relationship between the head of field service and the office of Bunch. Now, Bunch was dealing first, of course, with the two observer missions, UNSO and UMOGIP. In 1956, during the Suez Crisis, Dag Hammarskjöld created the first peacekeeping force with thousands of soldiers. Then Bunch was in charge of this very important and complex operation. The force in the field is commanded by a force commander, generally a major general. He reports directly to Bunch, and if there is anything extremely important, he would send cable to the secretary general. But normally, the cables would be sent to Bunch and dealt with by Bunch. And since there is a very close relationship between Bunch and the Secretary General, there is really no problem in the direction.
Could I just ask you to pause there a minute and ask specifically, would you say that in these cases, the Secretary General and Bunch in his place acted really as the commander-in-chief, if you will, of the operation that was taking place in the field?
Oh, yes, yes. There's no doubt. In fact, in various reports, it says that the peacekeeping operations is directed by the Secretary General under the authority of the Security Council. And in the case of UNEF, because UNEF was created by a resolution of the General Assembly under the authority of the General Assembly. But the Secretary General is the commander-in-chief. And then he said also the command in the field is entrusted to the force commander. In fact, in order to control, had to have a better control of the force commander, he decided to make the force commander a member of the staff. So the force commander is not only a general seconded by a government, but he is a member of the secretariat, a member of the UN secretariat staff, generally with the rank of assistant secretary general.
That is an interesting point, and that practice has been maintained, as far as you know, up to the present. That the field commander is in fact a member of the secretariat.
That's right. All the military personnel of peacekeeping operations are seconded by governments, except one, the head of the operation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, this involves really a trilateral relationship in a sense that is between the field commander, the secretary general or his deputy, and the Security Council or the General Assembly. Did this create problems in your experience in dealing specifically with the 1967 events? That is the peacekeeping operation leading up to 1967.
But if I may, I will go from the beginning.
All right, fine.
At the very beginning, as I said, the two first peacekeeping operations were military observer missions, UNSO and UMOGIP.
Right.
Those two missions, in the beginning, was not controlled, was not directed by the Secretary. It was directed by the mediator. For instance, in UNSO, the origin of UNSO was a resolution of the General Assembly, of the Security Council, adopted soon after the eruption of the first war between Israel and the Arabs. In that resolution, the Security Council called for a truce and asked the mediator, the UN mediator for Palestine, Count Bernadotte, to supervise the truce with the assistance, with the help of military observers. So when the military observers came, they were under the mediator. They were in fact an adjunct of the mediator. Now, the mediator, advised by Bunch, who was the deputy to Count Bernadotte, and who became mediator himself after the assassination of Bernadotte in September 1948, Bunch, in fact, organized the first operation, giving it the various principles and rules. And in order to direct the observers, he appointed a chief of staff, a Swedish officer for Bernadotte, and an American officer when Bunch took over. He was the chief of staff of the mediator, not the chief of staff of UNSO. See. But then when Bunch helped conclude the four 1949 Mixed Armistice Commission, he gave a very important role to the chief of staff and the observers of UNSO. And in August, when everything was concluded, he advised the Security Council, but the Secretary General, naturally, and the Security Council, that he would not be able to be too useful, that mediation, the remaining task of the mediation, could be taken over by a conciliation commission composed of government. In fact, it was composed by of France, Turkey, and the United States. They would deal with the political problems. But UNSO should be maintained because of the tasks given to UNSO and the chief of staff of UNSO by the General Armistice Agreement. That was agreed to by the Security Council. So after that, the mediator left. The chief of staff remained the chief of staff because the title was mentioned not only in the General Armistice Agreement, but also in the Security Council resolution. That's why the only peacekeeping operation with the chief of staff as a head, because normally the chief of staff is number two. See, he's the chief of staff of the commander. The head of UNSO is the chief of staff because of this historical reasons. Now, since the mediator no longer exists, something had to be done to administer and direct the observer missions, and that function was taken over by the Secretary General as a practical arrangement. And there will be no political controversy because the responsibility was not very great. As I said, the mandate, the functions are well defined by agreement. And the role of the Secretary General in directing the military observer missions were mainly administrative. Now, when the third UN peacekeeping operation was created, it was a different matter. It was no longer a military observer mission, but a peacekeeping force with thousands of soldiers. And here we have to recall, do we have time to, we have to recall briefly the history. Mm-hmm. When the Suez Crisis erupted, which came with the invasion of Egyptian territories by Israel and two major powers, France and Great Britain, it was a major crisis. The Security Council immediately met to consider the matter, but was paralyzed by the veto from France and the UK. So the matter was referred to the General Assembly in accordance with the provisions of the Uniting for Peace resolution adopted by the General Assembly after the Korean crisis. The General Assembly wanted to settle this matter, and he was able to do so because both the US and the USSR wanted to settle the matter with the withdrawal of the invading forces. Eisenhower, as you know, took a very strong stand. It was an election year in 1956. His advisor said you shouldn't do it because you might lose the election. And Eisenhower said, well, a principle is a principle for foe or for friends. Mm. So Israel and France and UK must withdraw their troops. So the General Assembly was passed during the negotiations. It was realized that a military observer mission like UNSO would not be enough, because the French and the British government has said that they send their troops there to maintain law and order. If the UN can do that, they would withdraw. And therefore, in order to maintain law and order, you need more than unarmed military observers. So Canada, in fact, it was Canada, it was Leslie Pearson, not Hammarskjöld, who had first the idea of a kind of police force to do the job. The General Assembly agreed, adopted the resolution proposed by Canada. But once the resolution was passed, it was Dag Hammarskjöld who took all the necessary practical measures to set up the force and make it viable and successful. So that was the history. And then, therefore, yes. And because of the General Assembly had no executive capability, it was a big body with many members, they meet regularly once a year, they couldn't possibly handle the complex organization and direction of a peacekeeping force. And because also Dag Hammarskjöld has demonstrated his extraordinary ability. So the Assembly gave a free hand to the Secretary General, and the Secretary General assumed the responsibility. He did everything. He decided on the form, the shape of the force. He decided it should be commanded by a force commander, should be composed of contingent, national contingents borrowed from various member states. He decided that the major powers should not participate in it. He decided that the force should be provided with live defensive weapons, but should not use force except in self-defense. Everything. And thus, And UNEF 1 was a big success. Within a few months, the various invading forces were withdrawn, and after the withdrawal of Israeli forces, UNEF 1 was positioned along the border between Israel and Egypt. On the Egyptian side only, because Israel refused, but it was positioned there, and once deployed there, it maintained effective peace in this very dangerous and strategic area for 10 years. So, because of this success, when the Congo crisis erupted, the Security Council this time decided to have a force very much like UNEF 1 and give the Secretary General a free hand to organize it. So the Secretary General came by force of circumstance to assume very important power to direct, to organize and direct, to manage the force under the authority of the Security Council or the General Assembly, but with only a modicum of supervision from them. That is how it was then. Now, but perhaps with hindsight, we saw that the Secretary General assumed too much power. The power assumed by the Secretary General became excessive in relation to the nature of his office. And some problem came in the Congo when the Congo operation became sour, and also with UNEF 1, when the Egyptian government, President Nasser, requested its withdrawal. Houtan had assumed responsibility for this very important move. So in 1973, when the October war between Egypt and Israel nearly led to a direct confrontation between the two superpowers, and then that situation was saved by the Security Council when it decided to establish UNEF 2. At that time, on the night of 24th to 25th, when the Security Council decided this, it asked the Secretary General to submit a report within 24 hours on the implementation of its resolution. At that time, the Israeli forces were pushing towards Suez Canal, and they could take the Suez City. They could take the Suez City any day. If the Suez City should fall, the Third Army, the Egyptian Third Army, which was the elite army of Sadat, and which was encircled, trapped in the Sinai, would have to surrender. And that was a very, very crucial matter for Sadat. So Sadat requested, addressed a direct appeal to the US and USSR for them to send troops to Egypt to enforce the ceasefire. The U.S. refused because it was its policy not to have superpower involvement in the area. But the Soviet Union and Brezhnev wanted to play the more important role there, accepted and was preparing to send troops there when Nixon addressed an ultimatum to the Soviet Union and placed the U.S. force under general alert. At that time, we were very near a Third World War, a nuclear holocaust. That was the most dangerous situation since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 62. So the Secretary General was aware of this. The Secretary General was aware of the importance of having the force there immediately. But he also knew that the Soviet Union might hesitate to adopt the force. So in his report, and we prepared the report in the Office of Special Political Affairs, we voluntarily surrendered some of the Secretary General's prerogative to the Security Council. So in the report it says the command will be assumed by the force commander, appointed by the Secretary General, but with the consent of the Security Council. Before the Secretary General, and particularly Dag Hammarskjöld, could appoint anyone he wanted without consultation. He also said that the national contingents will be chosen in consultation with the parties and with the Security Council. And more important, it says that any important matter which may affect the future functioning of the force would be reported to the Security Council by the Secretary General immediately for the Council's decision. And we included that in the report because we remembered the agony of the dilemma of Wutan. Now I think if you have a situation like this, we report to the Security Council.
And has that created problems? I mean,
Now, with this, mm-hmm. it functioned very well. Mm-hmm. You see, UNEF 2 was a big success. And in fact, when the UNEF 2, when we have a major crisis with UNEF 2, because after the conclusion of the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, under the auspices of the US president, President Carter, the agreement, the peace treaty, provided for the deployment of a UN force. And in their mind, in the mind of the author of the treaty, it was the UNEF 2, who deployed along the border. But since the Soviet Union was opposed to the treaty, we knew that the Soviet Union would veto the extension of UNEF 2. Now, the treaty was concluded, I think, in March 79. UNEF 2's mandate was coming to expiration in July 79. And during the whole month of July, we tried to persuade, when we say we, the Secretary General, various governments, including Egypt, not to veto it, but when it come certain that they are going to veto it, the Secretary General would just refer the matter to the Security Council. The Security Council had a number of informal meetings. When the deadlock persisted, on the last day, the Council decided to let UNEF lapse. Mm. But there was no crisis. The Secretary General was not responsible, was not accused of withdrawing the UNEF too. So I think it works better now.
So you think this procedure works better?
I think so, particularly now, right, with the new situation, with more cooperation between the permanent members. I think now the Security Council, and for that matter the newly created peacekeeping operations, are functioning much more according to the spirit of the Charter.
And actually, with hindsight, if this system had been in effect in 1967, then Wutan would have had to have consulted.
That's right. He would automatically refer the matter to the Security Council.
Now, what you're saying, I believe, is that with the establishment of UNEF 1, Hammarskjöld established a kind of guideline for how peacekeeping operations should be organized and how it should be managed.
Yes.
Somewhat later, as a result of the Congo situation, this special committee was established under the General Assembly, which became known as the Peacekeeping Committee.
Yes.
And while its first concern were financial, it later had the task of drafting guidelines,
yes,
which would be applicable,
yes,
to peacekeeping,
yes,
operations.
Yes.
My question is, did the Secretary General or the Secretariat seek to influence the way in which those guidelines, which were never agreed, were drafted, or did
No. We very carefully, scrupulously stay out of it. We let the special committee do it. In fact, the responsibility for serving the special committee belonged to the Department of Political and Security Council Affairs, and not to the Office of Special Political Affairs, because we want to stay away from it. As you know, for a long time there was a deadlock. Precisely on the question of command, direction, command and control, and on the question of finance. So there were never any guideline. They have a report, very short report, saying that they couldn't agree. Only recently did the special committee make a definite recommendation.
Do you think that that the operations have suffered as because of a lack of such guidelines, or
no? I think the guideline worked out by Dag Hammarskjöld and later on modified in 73 worked very well because it was flexible. We followed the outline in a very flexible way according to the political circumstances. In fact, as you know, over the years, the nature of the operation have changed and the way of operating. UNSO, for instance, which was created in 1948 to supervise the truce, had later on the mandate changed to helping the parties supervise the application of the armistice agreements. And later on, in 76, when the situation again completely changed, the UNSO observers were given the responsibility of observing.